Hello everyone, this is Mike Quincy, Connecting the Light. My guest today is Kevin D. Randall, who has for more than 35 years studied the UFO phenomena in all its various forms, and he was trained by the Army as a helicopter pilot, intelligence officer and military policeman, and by the Air Force as both an intelligence officer and a public affairs officer. And he has written extensively on UFOs beginning in 1973. So, welcome to the program, Kevin.
Well, thank you very much.
I shouldn't think there are many people that have so much knowledge of UFOs that you have, or have possibly written as many books or articles. And I certainly come across your messages, etc., on many occasions. Obviously, I have a lot of information about you, but prior to 1973, you must have had presumably some experiences of your own with UFOs. Would you like to tell us how it all started for you?
I often blame my mother. She was a fan of science fiction. Science fiction, of course, is about interstellar flight, civilizations on other worlds, contact with alien races. Ufology is not that far away from all of those sorts of things. So I took the step into ufology. So as I say, I blame my mother for my interest first in science fiction and then into UFOs. And it's sort of built from there.
Right. I mean, in all this time, have you actually had a sighting yourself?
I really don't know how to answer that, simply because back when I was in high school, I was a member of the Denver UFO Society in Denver, Colorado. And we were having a meeting out on a ranch south of Denver. And we're all sitting around the campfire, and we saw an object moving across the sky from north to south. And there really wasn't anything in a polar orbit like that at the time, back in 1967. So what I've seen is a light cross the sky. And in today's world, I'd say, well, it's clearly a satellite. And I just watched the International Space Station a couple of days ago fly overhead. So, and it looked exactly like that. So I saw something in 67 that we couldn't confirm as a satellite, but it was nothing spectacular.
Right. That seems rather a shame in view of your interest, because I think most people that do have an interest in it, like myself, somehow you expect to see something one day. So that's rather a shame, really. But anyway, you've been privy, I think, to maybe a lot more things than what the average ufologist is. So would you say undoubtedly that the most interesting crash, and this is the subject of your new book, must be the one at Roswell in New Mexico?
Absolutely. When you go on the Internet and you look up UFO crashes, for example, you can find some list of top 300. And that's just a preposterous number. They'd be raining out of the sky. It's like one a week since 1947. It's just one a month or something. It's just ridiculous. When we look at most of those cases, what we discover is they're probably a misidentification of a natural phenomena. And in the last 10 years, I think majority of the cases that have been reported as crashes are probably meteors. There's some spectacular stuff on the Internet of meteor falls, and you can look at those and compare them with some of the descriptions made of UFO sightings or UFO crashes, and they match to a great degree. So I think we can eliminate a lot of them that way. A lot of the cases are single witness. Some of them are single secondhand witness. It's not even the primary guy who saw it. And I'm just very bothered by those sorts of things. And in the last couple of days, or since the book came out, I probably should say, about 3 or 4 days after the book came out, I got a call from a woman named Catherine Baez, and her mother was Judy Wolcott, which was important simply because Judy Wolcott had told a number of UFO investigators that in 1953 her husband had been in the tower in Kingman, Arizona, and he'd seen the thing crash. Mm-hmm. And because that sort of corroborated another story that we had from a fellow named Arthur Stansel, It seemed like the 1953 Kingman crash was pretty good. Well, after the book came out, 3 days, 4 days, a week later, this Catherine Baez called and said her mother had a tendency to make stuff up. And her father Mr. Wolcott, was only 15 years in 1953, had not been killed in Vietnam, as Judy Wolcott had said, but had actually died in 2006, and her stepfather, Wolcott's second husband, was still alive. Clearly, her story of the Kingman crash, her corroboration of it, was untrue, and we could eliminate that. That leaves us with Arthur Stanzel, who was a guy who told everybody that when he drank, he tended to embellish his stories. And before he told the teenagers, who were the first ones to get the Kingman crash from him, he had had at least four beers, maybe a couple of martinis, and he told a number of other people the same thing. So that pretty well eliminates his credibility, as far as I'm concerned, not to mention there's no other corroboration for the story. So I think, given what Catherine Baez told me, that we can eliminate that story. Just this last week, I finally got an answer to a FOIA request on the Del Rio crash of 1950. And the main witness of that's a fellow named Robert Willingham. And he presented some documentation to prove that he'd been an Air Force officer. But we could verify none of that. The record center in St. Louis, which all records go to when you retire or you leave the military service, had just a short piece about him at the end of World War II. He'd been a low-ranking enlisted man. Nothing about him being an Air Force officer or a pilot. The one document he presented came from the Air Reserve Personnel Center in Denver. And it looked authentic, and I just got to the FOIA request that the document is not authentic. And so we can eliminate Willingham from that, and if Willingham has gone from the Del Rio case, then there is no Del Rio case. And so we pretty much eliminated that. In my book, both of those I treated with skepticism, but didn't have the final word until after the book was published. So there's two that we can eliminate right away.
That's interesting, because strangely enough, that was the very crash I was going to ask you about, because I couldn't remember reading about that anywhere. So I was going to ask you what it was about, because that goes back to 1950.
Well, actually, it goes back to 1948.
Oh, that's right.
I found in the MUFON Journal, it's actually Skylook, which was the predecessor to the MUFON Journal, I found a one paragraph in the February-March issue of the 1968 issue, the story of Willingham's crash, talking about what had happened, and he said he'd been a Civil Air Patrol officer, which is a civilian organization that helps with search and rescue with the Air Force and that sort of thing. Not the same thing as being in the military, but it's a civilian group. Found his story, which does not agree with what he says today. Have a copy of the 1977 affidavit that he gave that does not agree with what he said. The original date was 1948. The 1977 affidavit and information suggests 1950. And Willingham was saying in the last 5 or 6 years that it was 1955, or maybe it was 1954, or maybe it was 1957. He wasn't sure. But if Willingham wasn't a fighter pilot, and there's no evidence that he was, then the whole story collapses. So the date bobbles around all over the place. The details change. The aircraft he was flying changed. And when we get right down to it, we can find absolutely no evidence that he was ever an Air Force officer. And the only reason I had accepted this case as being authentic is because originally he was presented as a retired Air Force colonel. That's simply not true.
It does make you wonder why people would go to all that trouble to build up a false crash or a sighting, doesn't it?
If we look at it not from a ufological point of view, but from an overall point of view, there was a book called Stolen Valor, and it was about all these people claiming to be Vietnam veterans who were not. And it's sort of a way of, I guess, building up their ego and whatnot. And Willingham just said, well, he had been an Air Force fighter pilot, and he'd seen this UFO crash, and it brought him a lot of attention. I've heard him on radio programs. I've seen him on television. There's a book about him out. And I think that would be the reason he did it. It brought all this attention to him. So I think it was just a ego thing with him.
Yes, I think you're right. It's an ego problem. And they enjoy the publicity and the notoriety, don't they, or whatever is involved in it. Now,
If Willingham didn't have the UFO crash story, nobody would be talking to him. He wouldn't be on the radio. He wouldn't be on the television. So, absolutely.
Yes, that's right. Now, since you have a lot of knowledge of these crashed craft, did you ever get to see the film or the video that was released after communism collapsed in Russia? I think it was a KGB film of their military retrieving a very small saucer that had sort of half crashed into the ground. Did you see that one?
I have not seen that one, and so I obviously can't comment on it intelligently. I will point out that there was an awful lot of crash stories that came out of the Soviet Union, now Russia, that simply are not true. That one I haven't seen, so I don't know. I don't know the details on it.
Right. In that case, there's not a great deal of point in talking about it beyond the fact that it does appear to be authentic, because you see military vehicles coming up and a lot of military personnel getting out and sort of round the craft, and there's some men in civilians. It looks pretty real. Anyway, I was going to ask you what you thought about it. You see, had you seen this film? But is there evidence of any crashes in Russia? I mean, it's a very big territory, isn't it?
I think, and this sounds fairly parochial, I guess, that the only one that seems to have a body of convincing evidence and witness testimony to go with it is the case out of Roswell, New Mexico.
Right.
If you look at the world situation in 1947, the only really place that they're testing things that would interest you if you were a spacefaring race is in New Mexico. The first atomic bomb was detonated there. A lot of rocket research is going on there. Continued atomic research is going on there. And if I'm a spacefaring race, this is an area that's going to draw my attention. But since then, of course, a lot of countries have joined the atomic club. A lot of countries have sent rockets into space. The Soviets, later the Russians, of course, have sent probes to Venus, to the moon. The Chinese are now involved in the space race. I think, of course, the Europeans, space community has done a lot of interesting stuff. But back in 1947, it kind of made sense that you'd be looking at that one area of the world. When we look at other UFO crashes, there just doesn't seem to be the body of evidence, with the exception of the Shag Harbor case out of Canada in 1967. And that one is very interesting because of all the documentation that Don Ledger and Chris Stiles have found, showing that the Canadian government did investigate, the American government did investigate, the Soviets may have been involved, and they found an awful lot of documentation attesting to something falling into the ocean near Shag Harbor. So we've got those two very interesting ones simply because of the numbers involved, the witness numbers involved, the documentation involved. Beyond that, we start to run into cases where there's just not that kind of evidence available to us, which is not to say the Soviet Union or former Soviet Union, the Russians, may not have that sort of stuff buried somewhere that would be very interesting. But I just don't think there's been that many crashes, because it would be too difficult to hide all that information. And Shag Harbor may not have been a crash. It may have been more of an emergency landing where the craft went into the ocean in an attempt to escape probing eyes of we Earthlings, and was repaired and took off. So I mean, you look at it from that point of view. I think there's very, very few stories that fit into a UFO crash. I think there's misidentifications all over the world. And in the book, I talk about things from South Africa and things in Europe. The ghost rockets from 1946, for example, which were basically Scandinavian, but then we're seeing further south into Europe, and things from South America and Australia and Asia. So it's a worldwide phenomenon, but I think most of those cases are explainable in the much more mundane.
Right. Now, you're talking of the incident at Shag Harbour. From what I've read, I think you're correct in your final conclusion there, because there is apparently some evidence of this craft actually seen travelling underwater. So you're quite correct, I think. It wasn't a crash as such, although the craft was obviously seen entering the water.
And it may be an emergency landing. They did some kind of repair. There's also some suggestion that it may have been joined by a second craft, which would suggest somebody trying to help them out before it left the area. And as I say, it's pretty clear from the documentation that both the Canadian and the American governments were involved. At the time, the Soviet Union, there's some indications they may have been involved, but I'm not sure how solid that sort of information is. But it's a very interesting case because you've got people on shore seeing it. You've got police officials seeing it. There's a photograph of the thing in the air. Navy divers were involved in an attempt to retrieve it. There's fishing boats involved. There's governmental officials talking about this thing. So it's a very interesting case in that respect.
Yes, it certainly brought a lot of publicity. But coming back to the Roswell incident, I take it by now we can put aside the stories of the Roswell incident being related to a balloon or anything else other than a spacecraft of some description.
Well, what I try to say is, I think the Mogul explanation, one of the balloon explanations, John Keel had suggested Japanese balloon bomb from World War II. I think when we look at all that, we can pretty well say, yeah, it's not a balloon. That doesn't lead us directly to the extraterrestrial. It's other information from the witnesses, such as Major Edwin Easley, who was a provost marshal at the base at the time, that takes us to the extraterrestrial. But I don't see any terrestrially based explanation that accounts for all the evidence and all the testimony. So I think, when the skeptical community kind of latches on to the Mogul balloon, they're grasping at straws. I mean, they will say things, well, Mogul was so highly classified, of course they wanted to keep it secret. But when you look at it, you find out that it wasn't that highly classified. The purpose to spy on the Soviet Union was classified. The equipment was not classified. Even the name, although they would tell you the name was classified, we found the name in a number of unclassified documents from 1946 and 1947. In fact, Dr. Albert Crary, who was the leader of Project Mogul, in his personal diary, handwritten diary, mentions at one point in December of 1946, the Mogul equipment has arrived. Well, clearly the name wasn't classified. So the impression that you get of the entire Mogul story simply isn't untrue. Pictures of the Mogul balloons appeared in the newspapers on July 10th, 1947. Well, what kind of a highly classified project do you have when you have photographs of it in the newspaper? So you're right. The balloon explanation simply doesn't work.
No. Now, the Roswell crash, I think, caught our imagination in as much that as the facts came out, there were witnesses, I think, at the army base or hospital where the bodies of the aliens were taken. Do you admit to the fact that there were bodies retrieved, if not alive, a live alien?
There is good testimony from very credible people that there were bodies. There were bodies. My opinion, based on the research I've done, based on everything that I know, based on the interviews I've conducted, is that it was an alien spacecraft. The bodies were recovered from it. When you move to the realm of one of them surviving the crash, then the evidence isn't quite as strong for that. There is some evidence for that and some discussion of that. But the evidence seems to suggest they were all killed in the crash. There is a possibility one did survive and lived for a period of time after that.
Right. Obviously, there are are a lot of conspiracy stories which surround any incident of this nature, but I was very interested to know what your own feelings were. The fact that you've been in the intelligence side of the military or the Air Force, has that in any way taken you towards the UFO subject, or was that something that wasn't part of your sort of brief?
My job in intelligence, I've always thought, as being more of a reporter than anything else. And the various functions that I had as an Air Force intelligence officer, later as an Army intelligence officer, was to gather data and then provide it to my fellow soldiers to assist them in follow-on missions, that sort of thing. UFOs never came up. I do know that when the Air Force was investigating my background for security clearance, that they were well aware of my interest in UFOs, because the fellow conducting the background investigation happened to be a friend of my father, and told me that four of the articles I'd written on UFOs, two of them very critical of the Air Force, were in the file, in the background investigation file, but I still got my security clearances.
Right,
In the arena of what I did, I rarely came across UFO stuff. There was, when I was in the Air Force Intelligence Office, there was something called the Weekly Intelligence Brief, which was a classified document for the most part, but there was unclassified parts to it. And periodically there would be in there a UFO sighting, but usually in an unclassified vein. You know, the flight crew out doing this saw something strange, but nothing beyond that. And I never really came across anything exciting in my military roles about UFOs.
Right. Now, you tell us that you were the first writer to review the declassified Project Blue Book files, and that was while they were still housed at the Maxwell Air Force Base. Now, what sort of impression did that make on you? I mean, what was your conclusion?
This was kind of funny, because I was in Air Force ROTC at the time. And the Air Force had sent a little circular out, a newsletter, and said that the Project Blue Book files were now open for scrutiny. They've been declassified. And they were housed at the Air Force Archives at Maxwell Air Force Base. So a friend and I went down there to take a look at them. I managed to get an assignment from a magazine to look at them. We got there, and the people at the archive wasn't inclined to let us in to see them, even though they were declassified. Until he got a call from, and it was just kind of hilarious, Mr. Smith from Washington called and said, yeah, show these guys whatever they want. So we got in there, and they said, well, what files do you want to see? And we're going, well, we have no idea. And I finally just said, well, show, we'd like to see the index first, not knowing if there was an index or not. And they brought out this big document that had a listing of all 12,000 sightings. And I thought, there we go. That's what we needed. So we got to see all of that stuff before the Air Force went back through it and took out all the names. And what this fellow Bob Cornett and I had done, we spent 2 days going through the index, writing down all the unidentifieds, writing down the names of all the witnesses. So we could put all the names back into the file if we wanted to once the Air Force had crossed them all out. So it was kind of interesting to see that stuff. But going through the files, you know, I was very, very skeptical of UFOs until I started reading the Project Blue Book files and looked at the haphazard, lousy way they investigated the cases for the most part. Looked at it and discovered that while they say 700 were unidentified, which is 3 or 4% of the cases they involved, half of them were insufficient data for scientific analysis, which means they're not identified, they're merely labeled. So half the cases are basically unidentified. There are solutions to cases that are positively ridiculous, which means they slapped a label on it, but doesn't mean they're really solved. So the Blue Book files turned out to be a gold mine of information. And then when you go through and you look at the files, you know, the Kenneth Arnold sighting, for example, they very carefully marked out Arnold's name so you wouldn't see it. And there's even a telephone transcript where, you know, the KA for Kenneth Arnold has been crossed out, so you can't read that part. But across one of the pages, the top pages of the transcript, it says Arnold sighting. Well, you know, nice job of you know, the letters couldn't be any bigger and still be on the page. The guy didn't see it. Appended to a lot of the case files were newspaper clippings, so you got the names of everybody from the newspaper files, but they crossed them out in the paper. There were places where they just flat missed the guy's name, and so you could read it. So the Blue Book files were a very interesting thing to see, but this is while they were still housed down at National Air Force Base. I'm not sure if you're familiar with Jack Webb, who did the Dragnet stories on television, but he did in the 1970s a program called Project UFO, which was set up like Dragnet. They had two investigators, and they based it on the Project Blue Book files. Well, we thank Jack Webb for that, because he paid the National Archives to microfilm all of the Project Blue Book files. So, you know, in that time frame, later it became more, but you could buy a roll of the Project Blue Book files. There's 96 rolls available, but you buy a roll for $10. So, you know, if there was an area or a case you were very interested in, you could order that file from the Air Force. You'd get a whole whole microfilm, and I slowly acquired an entire set of the Project Blue Book files. But when Bob Cornett and I went through them, we were the first civilians to have access to the files once they were declassified.
Right. Now, I saw a documentary not too long ago, within the last year, which had some film taken in Germany, and the whole inference there was that during the wartime they had advanced to the point where they had actually made spacecraft similar to the George Adamski bell-shaped craft. Have you any knowledge about that?
I've seen the same thing. There's been a couple of documentaries on it, and I know that Adolf Hitler was so dumb that he didn't understand the capabilities of the jet aircraft that he developed and how it could have really caused trouble for the Allies toward the end of the war had they deployed the jet fighters properly. I find it difficult to believe that the Nazis were able to build something like that would work and not employ it to attempt to turn the tide of the war at that point. I just really haven't seen anything to suggest that they got beyond sort of some interesting experimentation with magnetism. And I know they found the remnants of some of the test facilities, and I've seen that sort of thing. But I don't think the Nazis built anything that's anywhere near what we're talking about today. And I think that it's pretty clear, based on the evidence from Roswell and based on other UFO sightings, whether they're just landing trace cases or something like that, that we're dealing with something that has a technology that is superior to any of that developed on Earth.
Now, I don't know if I have the name right here, but there was the alleged crash, or believed to be a crash, of a spacecraft at the Tunska area. Have I got the name right? Because you've undoubtedly heard of it. And I was wondering...
Tunguska? In Russia? Siberia?
Yes. Right, yes, that's the one. And I was wondering what you thought about that, because as we've gone along over the years and our own knowledge of craft and things like that, or futuristic crafts, has grown, you can see that whole area may well have been destroyed because the craft involved probably carried some sort of nuclear power device. Have you any opinion on that?
As a matter of fact, I do.
I'm glad you have. Right.
I actually talked to James Van Allen about that, you know, the radiation belts guy.
Yes, yes.
He taught at the University of Iowa, and I was a student there, so I had an opportunity to talk to him, and I talked to him specifically about that. It was his opinion, and I share it, that what happened was you had the detonation. He thought it was cometary, meaning a comet, and that the kinetic energy potential, as this thing collides with the atmosphere, sets up a dynamic, so they tend to explode in the air about 5 miles up, 25,000-30,000 feet, and it looks exactly like the sort of destruction you get with an atomic weapon. especially when they reviewed the stuff from Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But it there was no other remains. And Van Allen said to me, it's a very difficult thing to get an atomic engine to explode. You get sort of a low-grade fizzle, he said. It's more akin to the China syndrome, where the thing gets really, really hot and melts everything around it. But they don't detonate that way. And I think the evidence that has been recovered in the last decade or so, I know the Russians have sent a couple of expeditions in there, but I think the evidence pretty well suggests that this was a natural phenomenon. This was they're now talking about a asteroid. I think they calculated the diameter of it about 200 feet in diameter, and it detonated at about 25,000 feet, and that would create the sort of destruction that you would have seen in the early photographs of that area. So I kind of lean in that direction, that what we're talking about is probably some kind of an astronomical phenomenon as opposed to but that of course makes it an extraterrestrial event. But not an alien event.
Right. Well, the most recent findings that I read about that made me think there might be some possibility in it being some sort of craft was the fact that a group of people checking in and around that area that was destroyed found evidence of very strong radiation. So it sort of seemed to fit for the moment.
And I asked Van Allen that very question because that had come up a long time ago. And I said to him that I think it was cesium-138. And what he said to me was, yes, and snowfalls in Iowa City, University of Iowa being in Iowa City, Iowa, of course, often in the 1960s had strong radioactive response, and it was cesium-138. It was fallout from all the atmospheric testing that was being done in the 50s and 60s. And so that sort of thing may explain why you get the radiation signatures you do in that area, because the Soviets were testing their atomic weapons, not in that specific area, but in Siberia and that sort of thing, and that may explain why you were getting those elevated radiation readings. But in everything that I've seen from the scientific arena, suggests that this was a natural phenomenon.
Well, the point you've made there is quite interesting to explain the radiation. Now, I also read that you were amongst the first to report on animal mutilations. Now, you must have found a lot of evidence connected with these type of happenings. What do you think accounts for it?
Well, again, Jim Lorenzen, who was the international director of APRO, had called me right after they started reporting the animal mutilations in the mid 1970s, and said that to talk some, gave me some contacts and asked me to go to Minnesota and look into it. So I did. What we found in the majority of the cases, and I'm gonna preface it this way: in the cases that I have investigated, personally been on the scene, I have found nothing to suggest, again, an extraterrestrial explanation. I think the cattle mutilations have a terrestrial explanation. Now, not too long ago, somebody on the UFO Updates Network had asked for references about cattle mutilations. What could he or she read? I don't know if it was a man or a woman. Wanted to read something more about cattle mutilations, and people put up a bunch of different books that had written about that. And I put up and said, well, take a look at mute evidence by Kagan and Summer, and the report that had been sponsored by New Mexico, done by Kent Rommel, and I got an email from Chris O'Brien, who is a big advocate of the alien explanations, and he asked me a question. He says, "How do you explain the lack of copper in the blood of some of the mutilated animals?" Now, this is a fine question. I don't know the answer to that, but the internet's a wonderful tool, as you and I now know, because we're having this discussion over the internet.
Yeah.
I typed copper deficiency in cattle into to my search engine, and it gave me a whole bunch of scientific papers. And I discovered what causes a lack of copper in cattle. And there's all kinds of causes of it. And what I also discovered was, in the one specific incident he was referring to, it wasn't a lack of copper, but a copper deficiency. All the copper wasn't missing. There was just a deficiency in the copper. And so I see nothing to take me in a different direction. Just this last weekend on Paranormal Fact or Fiction on the Sci-Fi Channel, they were looking at cattle mutilations, and they had the picture of a mutilated animal and said, here it is, and there's no sign of scavengers or predators around it. And I looked at the picture on television. I looked at the picture. And I said, well, what about the bird droppings on it? There's pretty good evidence of scavengers. But they've ignored the obvious evidence of bird droppings around it. So why don't you see the footprints of skunks or other scavengers like that? It's because they may not have gotten there, but there's certainly evidence of other scavengers. I have not seen anything that leads me to the extraterrestrial here. And my real point about mentioning the Chris O'Brien thing was, you know, this happened just a couple of years ago, which means I revisit all of these sorts of things periodically to make sure that there hasn't been something new added to it that I've missed, so that when I'm asked that question, I can say with a certain amount of certainty, I am convinced that the animal mutilations are trustfully based, and it's just something that has gotten attention for some bizarre reason. But I think the real good sources on this are mute evidence by Summer and Kagan and Ken Rommel's report, who was the retired FBI agent who I looked into it for the New Mexico government. So I you know, those are two sources I think are very good, and the scientific papers on the internet explain some of it very, very well.
But wouldn't you agree it's rather strange that with the mutilations, it seems to be specific parts of the animals' bodies that are removed, and very cleanly in a surgical way, such as the tongue or organs in the body? Would that not strike you as being unlike, say, another animal mutilating these cows or bulls or whatever they were?
No. The very tissues that are usually taken in the classic mutilations are the very soft tissues that the scavengers and predators would go after first, because it's easier for them to get at. And secondly, on the Paranormal Fact or Fiction, they did an experiment, which I wasn't really a big fan of, but they bought a chamois, which is basically a cow skin, and put a bladder underneath it, fastened it all down, and then inflated the bladder to see how the skin would stretch and what would happen. And it tended to split along what you'd call the lines of grain, giving it the look of a straight surgical cut. So no, I don't see any evidence to suggest otherwise. What I would have liked to have seen them done, and they could have done, they had a cow that had just died, and so they, with a vet, attempted to make the scalpel type incisions, and they couldn't do it. And they tried to make the surgical laser cuts, and they were unable to duplicate what you see on the mutilated animals. So, that's very interesting as well. There was an animal that was found mutilated, not mutilated, but an animal found recently dead in Arkansas quite a number of years ago, and two Arkansas deputy sheriffs staked the place out to watch the process of decomposition. And what they found in that was, and I believe they videotaped the whole thing as well, but what they found was basically the classic mutilations, and it was done by scavengers attacking the bodies. So there's a nice body of evidence to suggest that what we're seeing in the animal mutilations is the normal decomposition of the animal after it has died. So it doesn't seem that there's anything that unusual about it. And I know this makes me people are my big fans now because I say things like that. But I just see nothing to suggest that there's any extraterrestrial component to the animal mutilations. And it's not that you know, I haven't looked at the evidence. I've tried to look at everything from Chris O'Brien's work to Linda Moulton Howe's work to Tom Adams' work. All these people who were on that side of the fence and looked at what Ken Rommel did and what Summers and Kagan did in their work and looked at all of this stuff and tried to draw a reasonable conclusion based on seeing everything.
Right. Oh, well, the only comment I would make to perhaps conclude that section on animal mutilations is... And one can't vouch for these reports. I did read one where some people allegedly witnessed animals being apparently beamed up out of the field to a craft that was above it. So maybe you can't blame people for feeling that that connection is there.
Most of the reason they believe the animal mutilations are extraterrestrial is because what they think of is the strange circumstances and the mutilations on the body. So I just don't really, unless I can talk to those people and get a feel for that, and there's some corroborative details, I just don't know what to make of that. I did talk to a group of hunters who had said they'd come across a number of animals who died from, I think it's called blackleg. And so just for laughs, they kind of mutilated them and they went off. And then within a day or two, they were talking about how these six animals had been killed by a gas grenade and had been classically mutilated. The hunters were laughing their butts off because it was just because they knew what the answer was. And the only reason I know the answer is I blundered into it because I was looking at into another UFO sighting case, and we're talking to these guys, and they just told me that story. So, you know, there's all kinds of things floating around.
The question I was about to ask you, and I did, although evidently something must have gone wrong there. You've written many best-selling books, and amongst those, you wrote Invasion Washington, UFOs Over the Capitol. Now, that's a well authenticated sighting, because the craft, and there were quite a few of them, were over the Capitol for quite a long period of time. So I wondered what your thoughts were about that particular sighting.
This is the kind of sighting that I really like, because you've got multiple chains of evidence. You have the airline pilots seeing the objects in the sky. You have fighter pilots being scrambled to intercept the objects. You have guys on the ground seeing stuff. You have radar seeing the objects in the sky where the people on the ground, the people in the air are reporting them to be. So you've got multiple chains of evidence. You've got some very good sightings. You've got some very credible witnesses. And you have multiple radar sightings of this. You've got people who are highly trained in reading what's on the radar scope. You've got fighter pilots who are trained in intercepting this stuff. And so it's a very good series of sightings. The Air Force explanation that it's temperature inversions is weak at best. Temperature inversion might affect the radar, but a temperature inversion doesn't tend to glow, so that you wouldn't have the guys, the pilots, the people on the ground, seeing anything. There'd be nothing for them to see. So it's a very good series of sightings. Took place over two consecutive Saturday nights in July of 1952 in Washington, D.C., and it is responsible for what I think of the greatest headline in any newspaper I ever saw, which was the Cedar Rapids Gazette, and the banner headline was Saucer Swarm Over Capitol. I mean, there's a headline right out of a science fiction movie.
Right, yes.
But it's a very interesting series of sightings. But it's not just limited to that, because when you look at the entire case, you find out there's lots of other sightings going on in other parts of the country and in other parts of that area of the United States right at that time. So you've got a wide body, a huge body of sightings all around that. And you have an Air Force who holds a press conference, which they claimed at the time was the largest military press conference held since the end of the Second World War. So you've got a lot of reporters there, and if you read the transcript of the press conference, you realize that the Air Force isn't really answering many of the questions. They keep kind of diverting attention, and this temperature inversion thing sort of evolves during the press conference, and the Air Force kind of gloms onto it and says, yes, yes, that's what it was, temperature inversions. But they don't answer a lot of the questions. They dodge a lot of the questions. And in the book that you mentioned, the invasion of Washington, I have the entire transcript of the press conference with my editorial comments in there about how they're manipulating the press. And it's back in a time, if you can think back that long ago, when the population tended to believe what the government said, didn't believe the government would be lying about stuff like this. And of course, now we know they'll lie about anything for any reason. Even when it's not necessary, they'll make stuff up. So that's a very good series of sightings, and it deserves to be closely scrutinized. There's another sighting from 1957, the Levelland, Texas sightings. And of course, because I happen to live in the United States, I'm most familiar with the sightings here. But here, and I bring this up in conjunction with the Washington National simply because here is another set of sightings where you've got the multiple chains of evidence, the UFO interacting with the environment. You've got witnesses at 13 separate locations talking about the things stalling their car engines and stuff like that. Had it been investigated properly in 1957, we might be having a different conversation. But everybody was so busy with their own agendas that we never got the proper investigation. And you have the Air Force actually saying, well, Don Kehoe, who was a civilian investigating UFOs, was lying, saying there were 9 witnesses to this, and there were only 3. Well, actually, both of them were wrong, because there's witnesses at 13 separate locations. And had anybody bothered to look, we'd have had a wonderfully complex and robust case for extraterrestrials.
Right. Do you think there's any single reason why the government operates this cover-up? And as you called one of your books, I believe, for the same reason, conspiracy of silence. What is behind it?
I don't know. I can understand it in 1947. I can understand it in the paranoia of the time. If, you know, you've got the thing that crashes at Roswell. They're able to hide it simply because Roswell is so isolated that it's very difficult to get to. Had the thing crashed near New York City or London or Paris or Sao Paulo, Brazil, they couldn't have done it. But given that they control the media, given that the reporters tended to believe what the military and the government told them, they were able to hide this thing. And I think the rationale is simply that they were surprised by what they had. They didn't completely understand it, but they also knew that if they could figure it out, get the secrets from it, that we would take, and we being the United States and our allies, take a huge step beyond our competitors in the world. Of course, that would be the Soviet Union at the time. So they wanted it, they wanted an opportunity to exploit this without having to worry about espionage, because everybody was doing a very good job of stealing everything from the United States.
And I
think because they didn't have a lot of answers, they were afraid to say, well, you know, here's an alien spacecraft. We don't know whether they're going to invade tomorrow or not, and we can't do a whole lot about it. So they buried it to see what they could figure out. I do not understand why this would persist till today. I just don't get it, simply because we all are much more sophisticated than we were in 1947. We understand an awful lot about what's going on in the world. We're all connected. We're having this conversation over the internet, for crying out loud. Something that, of course, didn't exist in 1947. Anything I want to look up, I can look up on the internet. I have to be careful that the information I'm gathering is reliable, but it's all out there for us to see. So I don't know why it persists today. There must have been something that they discovered that frightened them, and I think once they got it classified, and once they got it picked up, and once they realized the invasion wasn't happening, they were able to reduce the number of people involved in the research of this, which keeps it a lot quieter, and without some event suggesting they now have to release what they have, they just keep working it quietly in the background. The thing that I think of periodically is that scene from Raiders of the Lost Ark at the very end, where they've got the Ark of the Covenant and it's in this huge warehouse buried with all the other stuff they've got in that huge warehouse that they don't know what to do with. So I suspect as our technology improves, we apply that technology to this debris that we recovered, but I don't understand why the secrecy persists.
Mm. I mean, some while back, one would read that they would keep these things under wraps because they didn't want people to know too much in case they got frightened by the prospect of aliens sort of visiting the Earth. But I don't think you can say that any longer, because there have been millions of sightings over what we're talking about, 60, 70 years, straight after World War II. And I think people, you might say, are almost used to the idea of spacecraft being in our skies.
Absolutely. That's why I say I don't understand why it persists today. And as I say, we're much more sophisticated. Back in the 1940s, people thought of spaceflight going to Mars or Venus. Of course, we don't want to go to Venus now because we'd melt. But but we thought of it in terms of in the solar system. In today's world, we think of spaceflight in terms of interstellar flight, moving around the galaxy. We know that there's, what is it, 450 extrasolar planets have been discovered now. We found systems around other worlds, solar systems around other worlds. So we have a great deal more sophistication. I don't understand why it's still hidden. I just don't get it.
No. Now, to state the obvious, the craft that that come into our atmosphere are able to do things that we still can't replicate with our normal form of air transport. So it's quite obvious they are being piloted by extremely intelligent and advanced beings. Now, this is really your own personal opinion that I'm asking now. Where do you think they come from?
I have no clue.
Right.
And the thing is, I don't know, once you've solved the problem of interstellar flight, I don't know if short flights are easier than longer flights. Maybe longer flights are easier. I know if I want to travel to London from my home, it's very complex. If I want to travel to London from Los Angeles, it's much easier, given the dynamics of the way the aviation industry works. But I don't know the distances, interstellar distances, are easily manipulated, or if it's different. So I have no clue. I don't know where they come from.
Right. Well, that was really my final question. Thank you, Kevin, because the time's flown by as usual. We have a good chat, and I have to keep an eye on the time. I've got a few minutes left to ask you if you have a website yet, and if not, where can people get your book, your new book, Crash, which the full title is When UFOs Fall from the Sky?
Well, it's available at Amazon.com, of course.
Right.
So, and it's in a lot of the bookstores, so they can get it there. I don't have a website. I have a blog instead,
right,
which is at www.kevinrandall.blogspot.com. But the easiest way is just type a different perspective UFO into your search engine, and that's usually the first thing that comes up, and you just click on that and go to the blog. The latest entry is, UFOs and Negativity, which was a scientist said, well, the reason we don't believe the UFO nuts is because they always approach it from the negative, and I'm suggesting that we approach the research from the positive. In there's some discussion of the Trinidadi photos that have broken out, so that's what's up there. But if so, that's the blog. The book is available at Amazon. It's on Kindle. In fact, I have a science fiction novel on the second Tuesday of next week, which is also available on Kindle. So there's a couple of things going on like that.
Right. So thank you very much for a very interesting talk with you, Kevin. I'm very, very thankful that you came on. I've just got a minute or two to quickly tell my listeners that Carol Corey will be with me next week. She wants to talk about her predictions in respect of Earth changes, which she gives out quite regularly. So thank you for being with me today, and I do hope you can make it next week. Thank you very much. God bless you all.